Good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Brodie, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great opportunity to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Ken Ryman. He's a former atheist, and he served as a U.S. diplomat for 23 years. It's really great to have him on the show tonight. Ken, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor and pleasure, and thank you for inviting me on the show.
Absolutely, and thank you for your work, and we have a couple books we're going to talk about later. A lot of ground to cover tonight, but it's just awesome to have you.
It's great to be here. First time in Ohio.
Yeah. So. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Again, this is your journey home to the Catholic Church, but you have a lot of ground to cover. So let's go back to your childhood. Tell us a little bit about your family and what, if any, faith background there is there.
Sure. So I was born in Iowa, but my parents moved to Arizona. My mother is an immigrant from Japan. So she grew up during World War II, where Buddhist, Shinto, which is the native religion of Japan, was her influence. My father grew up in New York, was an altar boy. He lost his father when he was 10, so he was raised by a single mom, and he had a younger sister about 7 years younger than him, and he had gone to Catholic schools. But somewhere along his journey, he moved away from the Catholic faith. And then ended up studying Eastern philosophy and theology, Hinduism and Buddhism. And he met my mother while she was pursuing her PhD in linguistics at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I was raised in a family by two parents who had grown up with trauma. And they never baptized me. And we never talked about faith, except in the context of question everything. So I was raised, we never went to church. We went to church once a year during Christmas for midnight mass when my American grandmother would visit from Michigan. And that was really the only taste of Christianity that I had. My mother, as a professor, would teach American and other college students in Arizona State University Japanese. And in the summers, she would go to Japan to do her research. She was a leading scholar on kokuji, which are characters unique only to the Japanese language. So when she brought me to Japan, my grandmother, my Japanese grandmother, I was raised by her in the summers. And so my mother would be busy doing her research, and my Japanese grandmother, who spoke no English, had only a middle school education. She was a devout Buddhist. And she raised me in the summer. So my grandmother, to me, is the second mother. And because of her strong Buddhist faith, if anything, I admired and respected my grandmother. She needed me, and I needed her. So I would accompany my grandmother to my grandfather's grave, and we would wash the stone, we would bring flowers, we would light incense, we would recite the Lotus Sutra. In my grandmother's home, she had a photo of my grandfather, incense, and you know, every day she would pray in front of him. And so it was as if, even though he had passed away right before I was born, for her, he was ever present.
Yeah.
And I would always remember my grandmother saying, don't ever do anything that would dishonor your grandfather's name. Hmm. So if anything, my example of somebody who was actually practicing any faith was my Japanese grandmother. Hmm. And so my conversion story is unique in that, in most cases, Christians are converted by other Christians or Catholics by other Catholics. And in my case, it was the love of an uneducated Japanese devout Buddhist grandmother who taught me what unconditional love is, what it feels like. And when she passed in 2008, that's when she left me the greatest gift, which is an understanding that if my grandmother loved me like this, God must love me infinitely more. And all the Catholic teachings that I had received and studied all came together. It was an intellectual exercise of me saying, well, I don't know if I believe this or I don't know if I believe that, but the heart wasn't there. And when my grandmother passed, she gave me that. So I always say, even though my mother had a PhD, my grandmother had a PhD of the heart. Mm-hmm. And so it's to her that I credit my writing. And it's the reason why I've so wanted to serve in Japan, because I wanted to honor her. Mm-hmm. If she was from Austria or she was from another country, I would feel strongly about honoring the country that produced her and made her. Yeah. So as a young child growing up in Tempe, Arizona, to two parents who are highly educated, one with a PhD, the other everything but a PhD, studying philosophy and Eastern religions and Hinduism and Buddhism, I was never forced into anything, but I also had no foundation except who is telling me the truth. Mm-hmm. Why should I believe what you're preaching? Everyone that I see claims that their way is the right way, whether they're Muslim or Jewish or Catholic or Buddhist or Hindu. And that was very confusing for a young child. And so my argument was, you know, you say that God is everywhere. Well, so is matter. And prove to me. I haven't seen it. You claim that these religions are aimed to promote peace, and yet I see you promoting war. I see all the contradictions. I see somebody on the campus with a Bible saying, if you don't believe in Christ, you're going to hell. Right. And the only thing that I could think of, well, you know what? I'd rather go to the hell that my grandmother is going to than the heaven you're preaching about. Mm. Because for me, this woman was a saint. And I was naive. So I could not understand the concept that you're not giving up your heritage or your grandmother. I'm not betraying the Japanese nation or the Japanese people. But I had no grounding or understanding. And it was only until high school when I went to a Jesuit high school, Brophy College Prep. My parents had a very good reputation for education, so we wore the collar. It was an all-boys school. And that's where we had 4 years of mandatory religious education. We had mass as a school. And we had to do volunteer work, in which I did volunteer work at a Phoenix Children's Hospital, playing with kids who had cancer. And at that time, I would say my religion was atheism. That was kind of rooted in some Buddhist nationalist sort of traits. I was the only person with Japanese roots and heritage there. And surprisingly, I had the best score in religion class, maybe because I never took anything at face value, and I questioned everything. I remember writing something about the prophet Amos in a report. And I couldn't understand how a loving God could allow children to suffer. So for me, Brophy was a wonderful experience in that I had Jesuit fathers also teach, and I could sense that these men were not just interested in my development as a student, but my development and growth as a human being. And I remember every single paper that we had had the words in Latin, ad majorem Dei gloriam, yeah, to the greater glory of God. And every classroom had a cross. And the fathers respected the fact that I was not Catholic, that I hadn't, they knew that this is not something that can be imposed or forced. It had to be voluntary. And I felt like they respected my search and my quest, and I was, of course, respectful to them. And it was because of that Jesuit education, men for others, women for others, that I read about Father Pedro Arrupe, who was there in Nagasaki when the atomic bomb occurred, and he was helping Japanese people, triaging the wounded. He was a witness of this, that I thought, this is coming from a man who has seen the immense suffering of innocent Japanese people, and who tried to do something. And this is when my journey really started to begin, where I started to think about at the links between the Catholic faith, the country and nation of Japan, And try to reconcile and see where I should go. And in the same time, I had friends. We had a Baptist friend from Nigeria who would bring his Bible on the bus in middle school. His grandfather was a pastor in Nigeria. A very kind, nice friend. And we still are friends. And I remember him writing me a letter saying, I hope one day we'll be brothers in Christ. And I would argue with him.
Yeah.
And at times he would get frustrated and angry. And I would realize, oh, he really believes this. Mm-hmm. But for me, I thought all of this is rubbish and nonsense. Yeah. You can't tell me biologically or from a nature perspective that there's a Virgin Mary and then God has a son. It didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. And so what I did try to do was I tried to understand, why are you a Hindu? Why are you a Muslim? Why are you a Catholic? Why are you a Buddhist? And I decided I'm going to take the good from every religious faith and just not choose.
Yeah. Seems like there's probably some providence, you know, in that friend that you had and also the Jesuit fathers. In other words, you came from a very academic, you know, truth-seeking background. Right. And you don't always, you know, a young person doesn't always meet people who can field those questions and invite the questions, invite the search, rather than just shutting them down or dismissing them. It seems like providential that you had people who sort of encouraged and explored those with you.
And even more shocking, in the deserts of Arizona, you know, prophets come from the deserts.
Yeah.
I met my first Muslim in middle school. I had to do a project in school on a foreign country. And I was supposed to interview someone from that country as part of the project. So I decided I would do mine on India. So I went to Arizona State University campus, went to the rec center where college kids are, and I went up to somebody that I thought looked Indian. So I went up to him and I said, how are you? And he was very gracious and kind. And I said, you know, is it okay if I interviewed you? Because I have to do a report for a foreign country. And he said, oh, what country is that? And I said, India. And he said, you're fine to interview me, but I'm afraid I'm not from India. I'm from Oman. And I said, there's no such country called Oman. I didn't know any better. And this is sort of the seeds of a future diplomat, right? And he was Muslim. He was a devout Muslim. And he took a liking to me. He liked the fact I was questioning different things, including his own faith. And as I then entered Brophy, a Jesuit Catholic high school, and I saw my classmates involved in going to parties and, you know, talking about alcohol and drugs and women. And I thought to myself, well, you know what? At least I'm not a contradiction. I don't claim to be something and then you're not. So I thought, well, if this is what it means to be cool, this is what I need to do to belong. I felt even more confused and even more inclined not to embrace a religion where the people who are supposedly following it are not. Yeah. And here was this college kid, Muhammad, who doesn't drink, prays five times a day, fasts. And so I actually credit Islam and Muhammad for my disdain for alcohol. I can drink, but I also decided I don't need to do it. It's not something that I enjoy. And so, and on an understanding that you cannot equate a religion with the behavior of its people.
Right. Good point.
And so when 9/11 occurred and all the media, a backlash about, you know, Muslims and Arab Americans, I knew, I had a friend. I met somebody. And I can tell you this person is a good son, is a good brother to his brothers and sisters, is very thoughtful about his parents, is trying to lead a good holy life. He's trying to be a good Muslim. And so I had that counter to be able to say, you know, don't believe everything in the media, because That's, you have to test by yourself. Everybody has a different background. And so here I am having influence by a Baptist Nigerian immigrant kid whose parents came on a track scholarship, whose father also obtained his PhD. They don't drink. So I had, Nigerian food. I'd be able to go visit his family and have Nigerian food. Had a Muslim from Oman, college student, who also didn't drink. So help me with good habits. In other words, if you have something good and healthy to offer me, I'm willing to listen to you. But they came from two vastly different traditions, Baptist and Muslim. Yeah. And then I'm going to a Jesuit Catholic high school. and I have a devout Buddhist grandmother. So am I supposed to choose between two friends, East and West? Am I supposed to? This is the reason why I thought, you know what? These are good people. These are my friends. These are my family. I don't want to choose something and then somehow I no longer belong. Thankfully, friends who are good friends will accept you even if you don't practice their same faith. So I'm still friends with Dimeji, and I'm still friends with Muhammad, even though they try to convert me. They know, hey, I can't be converted. That's what friends are for. And I don't try to do the opposite, because I know for me, faith was not something that was given to me. It was something that was precious. And in fact, I ran away from the Christian. Of all the faiths, if anything, this was the last one I would choose. I didn't want to be a Christian. I didn't want to be a Catholic. And yet, when I studied and I learned about the Catholic faith, I thought to myself, oh my God, if anyone could make this happen, the virgin birth, Mary without sin, God the Son, Jesus and the Holy Spirit, it would be God. And so that was a revelation for me. And then I had different individuals. I went to Georgetown University because it's a Jesuit university. It was very different from my high school.
What were you studying there?
I went to the School of Foreign Service. I wanted to study something international. Being a product of the U.S. and Japan, my parents invested in language studies for me. So, my mother struggled with English. My father struggled with Japanese. They wanted to give me the gift of both worlds and both languages. So they invested in me. So Japanese and English are very different languages, very different communication styles. You know, in English, it's the one that's marketing and being aggressive and speaking that's the one that wields power. Whereas in Japanese culture, it's the one that hasn't said a word, sitting in the back of the room. That's the person that you need to talk to, because culturally, less is more. You know, use words like money, don't waste it. Now, there are exceptions to that, but it's a very different form of communication. In
it's
English,
not just the words, it's the manners and words.
Correct. In English, it's a yes or no answer. That's what we want. Get to the point. In Japanese, that's considered rude. Why would I force you into having to say yes or no? I should give you the opportunity and the space and the freedom to keep it a maybe. But we know when we're speaking what we really mean, and the person can interpret that as leaning towards one way, you know, or the other. So very different communication styles and patterns. And I thought to myself, okay, I had a great experience at Brophy. I went from being agnostic, I'd say, to theist, believing an idea, or agnostic, then believing an idea, okay, there could be a God. But then the question for me was, well, who is he? Well, which God are we talking about?
Right.
Are we talking about the God of Allah? Are we talking about the God of, you know, Catholicism? Are we talking about, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the Shinto sun goddess? And so this is where I would go into that chapel at Brophy when people weren't there, and I would just spend some time in silence asking, who are you? What do you want from me? Why do you care? And there was some peace in just sort of being there in the presence of God in the chapel. in high school. And if I was to say when the very first recollection for me of God's presence was I was about 6 years old. And after midnight mass, when my American grandmother visited and we went to a Catholic church for midnight mass, somehow that influenced me that I remember the day after my mom had quilted these zabatons, which are mats. Mm-hmm. And I would build a church with that. There were seven. So I would create one and I would go in there and I would pray. Which is very interesting because only once a year. And here, somehow I felt the need or felt a connection as if God was there. And I believe that there is someone trying to say, I didn't know what I was doing, but I'm building this Zabuton church, Japanese quilted from handmade by my mother, wow. Who's not a Catholic, who's not a Christian. How could she be? She was born during World War II when bombs were daily hitting the city of Tokyo and they had to evacuate. She was 7 years old when the war ended. She's a victim of war. She'll never say she's a war, but she's a victim of wartime trauma. All right. She knew from when she was born to when she was seven, malnourished, not enough food. And in fact, my grandmother, she would tell me, my grandmother was 20 years old. And so she was a young girl herself. And so my grandmother would give my mom a knife to say, if the Americans get you, make sure you use this knife to commit suicide because they're going to rape you. So this is the environment in which my mother grew up. Mm-hmm. So how could she be? So there was a long period in my life where I didn't understand how my mother wasn't able to provide in the same way my grandmother could emotionally. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I became a Foreign Service officer and I experienced death, picked up body parts, faced all kinds of life-altering moments that I realized, it makes sense. But as a child, you're not looking for a professor.
Right.
You're looking for a mother. And I think that's also what inhibited my ability to have a relationship with Mary for a very long time. Because I thought, I'm not worshiping Mary, I'm worshiping God and Jesus, and I can identify with St. Joseph, but I felt, why are all these priests and Catholics so devoted to her? Mm-hmm. I couldn't understand that until I started to separate my own mother and my own father with Jesus's parents and chose to adopt them as my spiritual parents. So I came to appreciate how someone's upbringing and background and experiences shape their worldview. And as I became older, to be less judgmental, because if I was in that person's shoes, maybe I would be the same way. And so I'm very grateful for God planting all these different people in my life. And even the journeys and hardships that I faced in the Foreign Service, I always wanted to serve one assignment in Japan to honor my grandmother and my parents and the two great countries and nations that I love.
Yeah.
And I wrote a book about it called Love Both, Keep Both. I'm a dual citizen. I was raised and born a dual citizen. And so I felt, if two governments allow this, and then one is asking you at 21 to choose, don't tell me to choose between my father and mother. I choose both. And it's not a government decision. It's a people-to-people decision. And so I really thought, when I published this in 2019, and the career end of everything, but I felt like I went through the proper channels. It took me 16 years I was writing this. I was just going to leave it to my kids for them to read. And then I thought, well, if my suffering can be used to help improve the way that we represent our nation, the way diplomats can serve as peacemakers, blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God, then hopefully someone else doesn't have to go through that same suffering. And in that process, took me 2 years to find an editor, a year and a half to get it cleared within the department. I prayed and I thought about Jesus's dual nature. What gave me courage to even write this story, Love Both Keep Both, my diplomatic memoir, was I thought, well, if you're a Catholic, you accept that Jesus is 100% divine and 100% human. Mm-hmm. You cannot deny one or the other. And I cannot deny my dual heritage of having a Japanese mother and American father and my love for both. So why should I only claim one, even if one government wants to have a monopoly over my soul? I wasn't going to let that happen. And two, I thought of Paul, St. Paul. He was a Roman citizen and a Jew. And so I prayed about it and I thought, you know, this is not about publicity for me. I don't care about that. What I care about is that some kid from Arizona or anywhere else in the world who was raised by loving parents has an opportunity to honor them, because ultimately when you're honoring your parents, you're honoring the creator that created all of us, regardless of whether they're Catholic or not. Mm-hmm. And thank God that I had the opportunity to face some of these hardships as a Foreign Service officer. My first assignment was in Taiwan, followed by Nigeria, and then Beijing, China. And every time I was denied the opportunity to serve in Japan, it was like a knife or a sword just piercing my heart. Because I thought, what's wrong with me trying to honor my parents and my grandmother? I would do any assignment there. I'm more than qualified. I have the language. You don't need to train me. There's a return on investment. I felt a great pain to not be able to be who I am. And so the message of Love Both, Keep Both, where I talk about Christ and my prayer and what gave me influence, is the idea you have to allow people to be who they are as a starting point. Yeah. Because true conversion starts with an honest assessment of where you are and who you are. Because from there, that's where the foundation. If your foundation is fake, a conversion is not going to be a conversion. It has to start from the bottom. Yeah. Every brick by brick matters. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people were part of that journey. And when it comes to conversion, I'm just amazed at how God could speak through so many different people who had integrity, and some who didn't, to turn me to Him.
Yeah. And the name of the book, again, that you were just sharing with us is?
Love Both, Keep Both, Passport to Peace, Prosperity, and Strengthened Diplomacy. And you'll see in the back, there's a photo of me with my Japanese grandmother, and there's a photo of me with my American grandmother, and there's a photo of my mom when she was a little girl, after, World War II. And it just sorts of paints a photo of that. And I wrote it to give some suggestions on how both the U.S. and Japan can better maximize dual national talent. The world has changed. There are many countries that accept dual citizenship nationality, and we are not a threat to anyone. In fact, the fact that we have family on both sides of the Pacific ensures that we're going to be naturally great peacemakers, because we want both of our families to be able to love each other and to be able to understand each other, and we don't want to embarrass family on either side. But I didn't realize how politics and other things Sure. can come into play. So this book is not a book about that. It's a book really about why it's important to embrace who you are and allow people to be who they are, because you're going to get the best out of them. And, you know, I wrote that with the idea that behind that was God's hand. Mm-hmm. And that led me to write my second, which is my conversion story, which targets not just Catholics, Christians, but anyone who just wants to understand how someone like me, mm-hmm. who started out as an atheist, would come
right
to this. And also a big message and audience for me of this book is there's no contradiction in being Catholic and Japanese, even though there's only a little over 1% of the population in Japan are Christian. And even though Jesus and Mary historically were never born in Japan, and that's why it's viewed as a foreign religion, it doesn't have to be a religion in which you say to yourself, you've abandoned your heritage, your family, your country, your nation. And right. so it sort of ties into the first book of allowing people to be who they are and giving people the space. The first book, giving diplomats the space to be able to look at what we can do to be better maximize diplomats for especially who have a heritage in another country for the benefit of both countries or more. And the second is the idea that, you know, we're human too. We bleed, and we need to pray for our diplomats. We need to pray for people who are trying to promote understanding and tolerance overseas, who often are serving in harm's way.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times as a diplomat I had to turn to God and my faith in a crisis. And plenty of other folks too. And you don't hear that. And so I think I want people to feel comfortable. It's okay. You know, you don't have to have a facade and say, you know, you think you know everything or pretend you know. Look, you know, I've served in Nigeria where I handled two plane crashes. I've picked up body parts. I know colleagues who have served in war zones. You know, I covered Ghana and Guinea in Washington, and one of the regional medical officers, medical psychiatrists, was found dead in a ravine one day. Those are things that can impact a community.
Well, there's a providence, as you were saying, right? You know, that God gives us these aspects of our stories and our journeys so that we can turn around and have an impact on other people and share that comfort and encouragement. We've got to run to a break here.
Okay.
But it's fascinating stuff, Ken. We'll come back and hear the rest of your story.
Kristen, thank you.
Thanks for being here, and stay tuned. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Ken's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Ken Ryman. He's a former atheist, and has served as a U.S. diplomat for 23 years. And Ken, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Of course.
You know, so much providential, fascinating content in your story in terms of your family background, your parents, your grandmother's influence, you know, her Buddhist background, how as a questioning, truth-seeking young man, you had these different people who were able to kind of field those questions and meet you where you're at. Fascinating stuff. And so what I wanted to pick back up on, you mentioned attending Georgetown.
Yes.
And you had this, you were in the chapel there. And so let's pick up there and pick up with your story. What happened there?
So the chapel was in Brophy in high school. But when I chose Georgetown because I went to a Jesuit high school.
Gotcha.
And I went to Jesuit and I had such a great experience. My freshman year, first semester, I was paired up with a roommate who was doing drugs, alcohol, partying girls, and he was Catholic. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm not Catholic, but I'm behaving more Catholic than you. I felt unclean. And I almost left school. My first semester, I called my parents and I said, you know what, I'm going to Taiwan and I'm going to join the Tsuji Foundation, which is a Buddhist foundation in Taiwan that does great work that's run by a nun, a Buddhist female nun. And she kind of reminded me of goodness and of my grandmother in Asia. So I thought about that and that didn't happen. because during my freshman year, I ended up falling in love with a Japanese girl who I dated for 7 years. And that didn't end up in marriage, even though we were hoping that would happen. And that story is also of heartbreak is also there in my books. But it was there that I really sought out a deeper faith. And I had an advisor, Father John Witek, who was the who taught a course on Asian civilization from the perspective of religion. So Taoism, Confucianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Shinto, and then Catholicism. And he never once tried to convert me. But he lived in such a extraordinarily simple and humble and modest way that I couldn't help but ask him, why are you not married? Why are you wearing a collar and doing this? And there were others like him along the way that I met who inspired me to take another look, a deeper look at the Catholic faith and separate sort of, you know, the media and my experiences and open my eyes to that there are people who really are living in such a manner that I would be proud to do as well. And so I went from Georgetown. I graduated and I did a year in Japan. I visited my friend Mohammed in Oman. And it was nothing but mosques and desert. And it was shocking to me how simple it was. But I could not avoid the voice of God. In Tokyo, with all the glitz and glamour, it's easy to forget. But in Oman, in the deserts, there's nothing. There's no movie theater. There was nothing there at that time. It was 26 years ago. So I had to confront folks who are daily praying and thinking to myself, what is there here except the presence of God? It's central. And so it was a huge contrast in terms of the environment you're in can play a role in whether or not you have the time and space and silence you need to try to hear the voice of God, who's always there if you just lean in. And so I joined the Foreign Service. I go to Stanford for my master's. I joined the Foreign Service. My first assignment is Taiwan. So rather than be a monk in Taiwan, I ended up being a U.S. diplomat. And that was a great first assignment. But the breakup with my fiance was devastating. I would walk until I was so tired that I had to go back home because it was too painful. I'd cry myself until it was a huge heartbreak. And it was then when I went into the Ricci, the church in Taipei, which my advisor, Father Witek, Father Witek was a leading scholar of Matteo Ricci, the Jesuit missionary in China. And he was a polyglot as well. And so he said, you should visit the Ricci Center in Taipei. So I would go to that church, and I remember feeling so saddened by the loss and heartbreak of not being able to marry my first love. And it was, again, Christmas Eve, and I was in the pew, and I saw someone who was there in the church who looked like a father, and I asked him, I cornered him, and this person was had not yet become a deacon, but he was in formation, Father Fernando Aspiros, whose brother ended up becoming the head of the Dominican order. But Fernando wanted to join the Jesuits. And so I was asking him all these different questions, and I ended up having him serve as a spiritual director. So I was hoping, but there wasn't enough time in my 2-year assignment to be to receive baptism there. So we had said, okay, well, my next assignment, Nigeria, I'll get baptized in Nigeria. Well, God had different plans. I went to Nigeria, and the closest Catholic church was 2 hours away. I didn't have in an area that I'm not allowed to go to without security permission. So I would go to church. We'd have a priest come into our apartments to give some mass. But I unfortunately, in Nigeria, dealing with plane crashes and terrorist attacks and the release of kidnap oil workers in the Niger Delta and everything that was there. And then also other health issues that I faced. I wasn't able to be baptized in Nigeria. It wasn't until my third assignment in Beijing, China, where that opportunity presented itself. And Beijing is the largest atheist country in the world. The Jesuits could not practice openly. The Chinese government appoints the bishops. And so you go to a church, Catholic church run by the Chinese, there's surveillance and there's other folks. It's not in line with the Roman Catholic Church. So these Jesuits were worshiping in their apartments. They were at a university where it was allowed for them to teach business and other courses. And I was facing a situation in Beijing where my grandmother had just passed away. And that was a very difficult period for me because my goal and one of my dreams was while I was a Foreign Service officer, I'd have a chance to honor her by serving in Japan, and that didn't happen. And here she passed away, and I questioned everything. What's the meaning of any of all of this? And so I had lost my fiance, I had lost my grandmother, I had lost my health, I had lost colleagues, I had picked up body parts. I just felt like, you know, what's next? But in my darkest moments, God was always there. And it's a miracle because when I joined the Foreign Service, there's certainly a lot of people who had their faith on their sleeve, whether they were strongly Mormon or strongly Christian. And somehow, some of those folks, unfortunately, went away and they don't have that. But for me, the opposite happened. Witnessing all the tragedies, seeing all the heartaches, I thought to myself, wait, there's got to be a God. There's no other way that there's some hope to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so I clung to this, and that was sort of my way to continue to seek a relationship and overcome a lot of the adversity that I had faced. And so when my grandmother passed away in Beijing in 2008, I said, you know, and she left the greatest gift, which at that point I realized the love, unconditional love she gave to me. And I had been reading the Bible, by the way, a Bible that had been given to me by the son of a former Japanese diplomat in Mandarin and in English. And I used that initially as a practical tool for language studies. And the bonus is I can learn a little bit more about the Bible. Yeah. And what happened was I'm learning more and more, and I'm just reading this, going back again and just reading. And so that reading the Bible, going to Mass, going to churches, and I thought if my grandmother passed away, I didn't know how long I was going to live. I was coughing for about 10 months because of the air pollution and maybe some weakened lungs from my tour in Nigeria, where when I was going to pick up body parts, the anti-malaria pill we're supposed to take, I guess I didn't drink enough water. So I'd end up burning a hole in my esophagus and I couldn't swallow. So I had to get that sort of patched up. So I think maybe it weakened my esophagus and lungs a little bit. And then coupled with the pollution in Beijing, I was constantly coughing. And so I think all of these tours were catching up to me. And so I thought, it's now or never. And there was a human resource officer who said that he had gone to St. Meinrad Seminary in Indiana. Turned out that wasn't briefly, but he didn't graduate from there. And he viewed himself as a pastor and he could baptize me. Mm-hmm. So for me, if the Jesuits, I was like, I don't know if tomorrow is guaranteed. I saw a colleague in Nigeria on a plane crash. He's no longer with us. That could have been me on the plane. So I said yes, and there's a witness, and in his apartment, he donned his robe and he baptized me. Now, I didn't realize that that wasn't all according to the church, Catholic Church, norms. But that was also, I was able to talk to folks in my diocese and others who said, hey, that doesn't sound exactly the way we would do things. But they said, no, you know, your baptism is valid. But I went through the proper channels as well to contact the church, make sure all of that. So it was September 2nd, 2008. And from that point on, I felt that I was saved, but I had a mission. I had to go back to Japan. I needed to find a way to, I didn't have a chance to attend her funeral, to grieve. So I wanted to go back to thank her. And what I did was I went to her gravesite and I remember praying to God to say, God, if I've done anything pleasing to you in my past or in my present or in the future, please credit all of that to my grandmother. I know she's not a Christian. I know she wasn't baptized a Christian. I know she's not Catholic, but I will take her place. So if I've done anything, please save her. Please save her, because that's how much she means to me. And I believe that God used her as a vessel.
Which is such a thoroughly Catholic, intuition for you to do that. And I've always thought it is interesting that the Buddhist sense of a communion of saints of sorts, of having this connection to family members that have gone and praying for them, right? That intuition was there. And also even the intuition of that we, with Christ, can participate in offering up our sufferings and our, for the sake of others. So that's beautiful. Yeah.
And so afterwards, while I did less than a year leave without pay in Japan, I worked as a business development manager in the nuclear industry. I knew nothing about nuclear, but I covered that in Beijing, and there was an opportunity. And so I was able to serve as a bridge between a company, Westinghouse, that was an American company, and Toshiba that had acquired it, and each didn't have their language and speak it. So I got to be kind of a business development manager and a liaison in that role, which is a great fit and natural fit for me. And at that time, I was going to catechism courses as well. And I thought to myself, God, you're either going to make me a priest or you're going to find me a wife. And in the same building, on the same floor, across the hall, was where I met my future wife. And what's amazing about the story about her, Eriko Tsuji, her last name is Tsuji, her character in the family name has a cross and then the snake radical. And I thought to myself, well, I'm a Catholic. I'm, believe in Christ. And I was born 1977, the year of the snake. So God really did find the perfect wife. And I said to her, look, I've got this volunteer cable. I don't mind staying in Japan. I've got this volunteer cable for Guyana. Are you interested? Thinking she'd say no. I asked her three times and she said yes. And I said, well, why do you want to go to Guyana? I mean, she said, well, she wants to see the world. She had her education in, UC San Diego. Or San Diego State, studying accounting there, and she's visited Mexico, but she didn't really, beyond Japan and that experience, see the world. And I thought, well, that's one of the reasons I joined the Foreign Service. So I thought, okay, well, but I'm not going without you, so you have to marry me. And I thought, well, if she's willing to marry me, I have no status, Japanese don't need visas, they're not going to follow an American just to get a visa or to go to Guyana. Mm-hmm. I thought, this must be love, so I'll take my chances. And she agreed. In Foreign Service fashion, we got married at the court, so she could be on my orders. And then she joined me in Guyana. And we said, if things don't work out, we'll go back to Japan. Well, two kids later, she became a U.S. citizen. And because we weren't married in the church, as we were doing our baptism and confirmation for our kids, who, by the way, were both baptized in Wolfington Chapel in Georgetown in a Japanese English ceremony. We had Father Anton Usuler, who is a Jesuit priest whose father, he's the son of a Turkish diplomat, former Turkish diplomat and American mother, who studied Japanese and, in fact, met one of Maximilian Kolbe's survivors. So that Maximilian Kolbe influenced him, and my second son Max was named, I named him after that Saint Maximilian Kolbe, and my son John after Father John Wycheck from Georgetown. So here they are baptized and confirmed, and as I'm bringing other family members into the church, they're bringing me into the church, mm-hmm. in that my wife then took 10 years, by the way. She's comes from a line of Shinto priests. Her great grandparents were Shinto priests. So she became, she saw how our kids going to Catholic school and education and going to Mass had such a positive influence that it took time, but she ended up deciding herself also to be baptized. And then during that process, we found out, well, your marriage hadn't been. So then we had to then go ahead and get married, have the sacrament of marriage renewed. And I said earlier, I thought, hey, I want to be a priest. Well, I had to be a priest for celibate for about 5 months because they said during this process, you cannot have marital relations. And I thought, wow, God, you really have a great sense of humor. So he fulfilled my wish, I guess, briefly. But now I guess I'm a father in the house and priest in the household. And I thought to myself, how is this woman, Japanese woman, willing to say yes to follow me? And this is, she has much more faith than me. Here I am going to Japan, taking catechism, and God's asking, will you follow me? And I said, well, but not yet. Wait, let me just wait. Like, but you could just do that for me? I mean, I'm not God. I'm just an ordinary person that cannot get, I'm not wealthy, I'm not famous, anything. And so I was really struck by that and inspired by her. And that's when I also knew this was the right person for me. So we are a Catholic family. We are in Virginia. And our kids went to Catholic child care and were baptized. And St. Gabriel was where they were. Went to, I guess, pre-K. And then... as part of my diplomatic journey, we went to different parts of the world. More of those details are in my book, yeah. and in my second one, Abandon No More. So
it's just an incredible story, Ken. You know, and I really imagine this is true with all the journeys that we hear about on this show. But in yours in particular, there are going to be people who, because of different aspects of your story, the cultural, the linguistic, the truth seeking. There's so many aspects of your background I think people will be fascinated by. And so they can learn more. Again, the titles of those two books here before the end.
Sure. The first book was Love Both, Keep Both.
Keep Both, yeah.
And this one, dedicated to God, is Abandon No More, an Ambassador of Christ.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So.
Awesome. All right. And then just a couple minutes left here. But again, you brought a couple show and tell here on the show here. So let's...
So this is a rosary from Akita, Our Lady of Akita. Mary appeared to Sister Agnes in Yudaida, Akita Prefecture in 1973 before mm-hmm. Pope Benedict became Pope and he was a cardinal. He went to visit to see the miracle of blood or weeping from the wooden statue of Mary there. So the idea that Mary never showed up to Japan or doesn't care about Japan is a myth. Mm. I want people to understand and pray for the people of Japan as well. And the way we do that is by our example. And then that's finally, I received this. It's a relic of Maximilian Kolbe, which I received from a diocesan priest. Right before Max Ryman, my youngest son's birth, Max Joseph Ryman, and my eldest son is John Francis Ryman. And I think really the only gift that my wife and I can give our children is the gift of faith and a relationship that we know they will have to cultivate and hopefully will be inspired to lean on God. Because at the end of the day, no one lives forever and you cannot bring anything with you. But the legacy and the memories, certainly that my grandmother left, that unconditional love is almost eternal. I mean, my body will be gone, but that unforgettable, unconditional love remains and is why my next journey is to try to help Japanese people. And I want it translated in some way so that more Japanese Inuit people can be saved and also can look towards Catholicism as a way forward in a voluntary way. I'm not the savior. I'm simply someone who is a messenger. So it's God's job.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to go in to intervene in his role, but I think saying thanks and being mindful and grateful to other people, tolerance and understanding. I think Father Wycheck was a great example of a scholar, but an extraordinary man who just led and listened. And naturally, people will then ask you, how is it that you can speak 10 different languages and you can do all this? Oh, what do you mean? Behind this is God? And well, how do I get that?
Right.
How do I do that? And yeah. I think that's where things led for me. So I thank God for the opportunity. Thank you for having the show and for inviting me. And I hope it'll inspire more people to embrace the Catholic faith and allow people to be peacemakers.
Yeah.
So blessed are the peacemakers.
Blessed are the peacemakers. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ken.
And
thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Ken's story was an inspiration to you. Let's keep praying for each other because we remain people on the journey, pilgrims on the journey. Until next time, God bless.